At the Nuclear Power and Children's Health Conference that was held in Chicago in October, much of the focus centered around the past, present, and future human and planetary costs of nuclear power. But one speaker offered a brighter alternative to a future with nuclear power. Harvey Wasserman, a veteran anti-nuclear and environmental activist, is a senior editor of the Free Press. Wasserman says wind power alone can supply all of America's electricity.
Wind power now blows nuclear power away. No one will ever build a nuclear power plant in this country or on this earth with the hope of gaining a legitimate profit. There is no way that nuclear power can compete with wind energy in current prices. Now, the federal government may step in, or some other governments in India or China or wherever may step in. They're done with it in Europe, but they may step in, or except for Finland, I suppose, but they may step in and build nuclear power plants with federal money or government money. And of course, we will have to stop that. I believe we can stop it. But the reality is that no one who is legitimately interested in profit will ever build another nuclear plant for one simple reason. Wind power is cheaper. Nuclear power can no longer compete with commercial-scale wind power. The reality is, and the basic reason is, there is one simple fact that Ronald Reagan overlooked when he tried to kill the wind power industry in this country and in this world in the 1980s, and it boils down to one word, Denmark. The fact of the matter is that we had, in the 1980s, really in the late 1970s, the United States had the unchallenged lead in wind power on this planet. Thanks to Jerry Brown putting in those tax credits in California, there were 17,000 windmills built in California in the late 1970s and early 1980s. About half of them worked. About half of them were scams for tax credits, but that's kind of the way it goes. And at that time, the United States had 95% of the wind-generated electricity in the world. It was marginally cost-effective. And I suppose at the time, the industry, if it didn't calculate on accidents and environmental impacts and on waste storage and all the other stuff they never talk about, I suppose they could say that wind power was more expensive than nukes, but it is no longer even in the ballpark. Even the least optimistic people who talk about commercial-scale wind power these days say it's 4 cents a kilowatt hour or cheaper. We do not need a Manhattan Project for wind power. Wind power is here. It's been here. They may improve it. They'll certainly improve it. But they're going to get it down to maybe 2 cents, maybe a cent and a half. There's going to be a limit below which they can't get it. The reality is now it blows away nuclear power, it blows away coal, it blows away natural gas, which is running on short supply, and it certainly blows away oil. There is no cheaper way to produce additional electrical generating capacity in the United States today than building wind power, certainly west of the Mississippi. Now, it's been said, and I have Arjun Makajani's beautiful latest piece here about wind, and it's been said and it's been proven for a long time that west of the Mississippi we have at least three times a capacity, wind capacity, to generate at least three times as much electricity as the United States uses today. At least three times. In the states of North Dakota, Kansas, and Texas alone, we have enough wind capacity to generate 100+% of all the electricity consumed in the United States today. That is a simple fact. It's an undisputable fact. The fact of the matter is that the technology has been improving. To do a little historical detour here, the first known windmill to operate in the United States, what became the United States of America, was actually constructed in the 1660s in Manhattan by the Dutch. I found this out by a guy who is even more frenetic than me, who is the head of the Wind Energy Trade Association in Copenhagen. He says, "You Americans are crazy." He pulls out this book. He shows me a wind cut of a windmill in Manhattan in the 1660s. So we are no strangers to wind power on this continent. And it's old technology. It's been around a long, long time. In the 70s, I think a lot of us thought that photovoltaic cells would come first and that all the rooftops would be covered with PV and the wind would come second. But we overlooked two things. First of all, there's many, many centuries of history with wind power. And secondly, wind power is basically simple stuff. It is not rocket science. There are not a whole hell of a lot of moving parts, even in your very large windmills. Now, for your scientific edification, I've done some schematic drawings of windmills here. Basically, the technology is pretty well set. Three blades into the wind. There's a wonderful guy named Paul Gipe. If you're interested in the technology, G-I-P-E. He's had some books published by Chelsea Press. He's a total curmudgeon, wonderfully disagreeable. And basically he says, and Dan Jewell says, and I think most people agree, that it's going to be three blades into the wind. That's the technology we're going to have. There are vertical access machines. There are machines that are being put on rooftops. Probably not. It's probably all going to be one big tower with three blades. There are basically two kinds of windmills that are going to be with us for a long period. Big ones and little ones. Now, the little ones, you see around houses, there are a couple of companies, the Bergey, B-E-R-G-E-Y, which is a family business out of Oklahoma. There's Southwest out of Arizona. There are a few others entering the field. These small windmills work. They're good for home and garden, basically. We thought originally maybe there'd be a lot of windmills in the suburbs. I don't think that's going to happen. The wind is too turbulent, and the windmills don't make much noise anymore, but they make enough to be an annoyance in most suburbs. You will not see, I don't think, a lot of windmills in suburbs. You will see them on small ranchettes. Like, by the way, George Bush does not have a ranch. It's a ranchette. It used to be a pig farm, and according to Jim Hightower, he can't ride a horse. Oh, God. Anyway, so... getting back to wind power, the big ones are the ones that are the future of wind power in terms of us fighting nuclear power. We have had tremendous breakthroughs in wind power in the last 10 years. Really, the major breakthroughs came in the mid-1990s when the Dutch really got their feet under the technology. There were four large companies four large Danish companies. They've now merged their three. Micon recently took over Vestas or vice versa. We call them Mestas. There's one in Germany, Enercon. There's one in Spain, Gamesa. Mitsubishi in Japan. There's a new one now coming out of India, Suzlon. The Chinese will probably enter with their own. But basically, there are going to be 10 companies in the world or so that build large windmills. And the big ones have made tremendous progress. One of the most important pieces of progress they've made has been in my home state of Ohio. I live in Columbus. Nobody ever thought wind power would work in Ohio. Suddenly, and they were right, actually, until 2 years ago. 2 years ago, the city of Bowling Green, which not accidentally has a municipal power company, decided to put up two large 1.8 megawatt machines. In other words, 500 of them would totally displace the capacity of a nuclear plant. These machines could not have been erected profitably 5 years ago because the wind in northern Ohio, basically where they put them, is class 3. Best is class 7, acceptable for wind power, had been class 5. Then as the windmills got better, it went down to class 4. Now it's at class 3. Vestas put up two very big 270-foot towers with a propeller housing, which is called a nacelle, three blades into the wind. The blades, I think, are, well, they have to be less than the size of the tower, obviously, so they're not that much less. You got to be able to, the wind, they have to miss the ground by the height of a tall cow. So, but other than that, they're really big. So basically, a year ago, September, these two windmills went in, 1.85 megawatts each, and we now have a year of data, and they are ahead of projections. So they are operating profitably. You figure it's $1 million a megawatt for a windmill, so they cost $1.8 million each. They're going to put up two more. Their principal customers are other municipals. And this is a political issue that I'm going to get into right now, because now that we've established that wind power is the future, and it is, it would only take several hundred thousand, at most, windmills west of the Mississippi to completely supply all the electricity west of the Mississippi. We're also going to talk about offshore, which is coming next. But the reality is that there is one American manufacturer left in the business. Guess who it is? General Electric. There was, sorry to say that, bearer of bad news, don't blame me, but at first it was Zond. I mean, Reagan, in the late 70s when Jimmy Carter came in, there was a boom in renewables. There were tens of thousands of people working in the renewable energy industry. We had all sorts of wind power companies looking to the future. One of them, Zond, in Tehachapi, California, stood out. They seemed like they were going to have the lead. Then they were bought by guess who? Enron. And when Enron went down, Zond was just about the only division they had left that was making any money. And Zond actually made a good windmill, and a fair windmill, I'd say. It wasn't as good as most of the Danish machines, but it was okay. It was competitive. And when Enron went down, General Electric bought them. So General Electric inherited Enron's wind business, which originated with Zond, and they are now really the only major manufacturer of large-scale commercial-grade windmills in the country. Now, by and large, they seem to be pretty good. Technically, but it makes me very uncomfortable to have the primary or one of the two primary nuclear guys also owning our number one wind manufacturing company. This is something we're going to have to face. You know, we can no longer go out there and just blankly advocate wind. Wind is a business. I'll tell you a little story. I went to my first wind power conference a couple years ago. I was all excited. You know, I dressed in my usual rags, showed up expecting to see a couple thousand hippies, and I walked in, and I thought it was a banker's convention. There were 1,699 guys in suits and me. I mean, it is a big business. There are very large corporations involved in the wind industry now, and if you go to any trade show involving wind power, it is very, very corporate. And that's one of the things also I want to talk about. So we now have General Electric dominating. They make two machines. They make an on-land 1.5 megawatt machine, which is supposed to be very good. And, you know, if you go into the wind business and you want to buy a machine, might want to buy one from General Electric. They're domestic, and they maintain them. When your windmill goes down, you got to have somebody to call, and GE is probably as good as anybody to call. But the other thing that's really happening is they're one of the only two that's building the offshore machines. Nobody really knows the capacity of the wind offshore. We've continually been upgrading the capacity on land. As the satellite mapping improves and as we learn other things about how to figure out how much wind there is, it appears there's more and more. And so we have a good convergence because we're finding more wind and we're also building wind machines that are more capable of using less wind. The wind machines in Bowling Green are bigger than they've ever been, like I say, the 270 feet off the ground, and they're slower. It used to be you had to get certain RPMs per minute. Now you can have less. And that means that you can harvest less wind more profitably, and that's why we can now have wind power in northern Ohio, which should very rapidly displace that goddamn Davis-Bessey nuclear plant as fast as we possibly can, but that's another story. So GE is also building an offshore machine, 3.5 megawatts. One of the Danish companies is also building an offshore machine. We'll probably see Mitsubishi get into it, but it's big, big money and big, big investment. Now, the good news is that we don't know how much offshore wind there is, but there seems to be a virtually limitless supply. So not only can we generate three times as much electricity as the United States uses but with windmills west of the Mississippi, but we also probably can generate that much again with windmills not only offshore on the coast, but also in the Great Lakes. And we have found now the latest wind maps that come out show class 7 wind in the middle of Lake Erie, which is the best wind you can get. And very clearly, the wind capacity in the middle of the Great Lakes is going to be huge. The Great Lakes are good in certain sense because they're shallow and they're not that far from big cities. And there's certainly less turbulence there than in many places in the oceans. So we're going to see huge breakthroughs. Unfortunately, as far as I'm concerned, it's all going to be corporate owned. Not many small farmers in the middle of Lake Erie are going to be putting up land behind their house. But that's something, again, we're going to have to deal with. We have to go very carefully at that. For example, we're now seeing, and people are, you know, go shake their heads, the opposition to the wind farm in the Golden Triangle between Cape Cod and Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket. And Bobby Kennedy Jr. has been in the forefront of that opposition. And many of us who are in the wind, promoting wind, think this is, well, it's mixed. I believe that scenic issues are legitimate issues. If people don't want to look at windmills, they have the right to at least vote on not looking at them. And if they lose, they lose and they go up. If they don't, then the other issues which are important to mention are bird kill and noise. The noise issue has basically disappeared. You get a swooshing from the blades, but there's really the turbine itself no longer makes noise that's noticeable. That's gone. And onshore, because the noise is so limited, the people who are going to hear the noise are the ones who are making the money off of it. So it pretty much works out. Nobody a reasonably short distance away from even a very large windmill is going to hear it anymore, and that's not a problem. Bird kill is a legitimate issue in certain areas, very, very limited areas. There are places where you cannot put windmills. Narrow migratory zones are basically the ones. They managed in California to build the among the some of the first windmills at Altamont Pass in California, scene of that terrible Rolling Stones concert. And that is a bad place for windmills. You got birds flying through. It's tight. They can't get around. And a lot of birds of prey, raptors, have been killed there. Of course, now the Cato Foundation has taken that one spot and taken the number of dead birds per windmill and multiplied that by all the birds in the world and all the windmills in the world and proven that windmills will kill every bird on the planet. It's very touching to see the industry so worried about birds now, especially after what happened at Three Mile Island. But the reality is that in Kansas, in Nebraska, and offshore, these windmills are big, they're slow. It will take very suicidal birds to get killed. We could probably spread Prozac around the area and avoid any bird kill whatsoever. And my buddy Dan Jewell has 17 windmills on his property in southwestern Minnesota and has yet to have a bird kill. One of the major factors is that the towers are now different. The original towers in California were pretty much all latticework erector set towers. And the birds of prey would perch on them, and they would spot a groundhog or a squirrel or something, and they'd dive through, and they'd get clunked by the blades. All the towers now are tubular. They're slightly more expensive to build up front, but they build them that way because there's virtually no maintenance. And the birds can't perch. So that problem has been solved, and I'm a bit angry at the Audubon Society and the opponents of the Cape Wind project for saying that bird kill will be involved, because offshore it's virtually non-existent. You are very, very unlikely that there will be significant bird kill on any offshore wind machines. The visual impact, okay, we can argue about, but as far as I'm concerned, and this is crucial for our discussion, it's an ownership issue. You know, it's great to advocate wind power, and we're all going to do it, and we all feel that wind power is better than nukes, of course. But the question then becomes, who owns these machines? These machines are very, very profitable. There is going to be a huge amount of money made in wind power. Now, if you want to invest in wind power, you don't have to do it through GE. There are other places. Do the three blades into the wind. Don't look at the so-called, so far the vertical axis guys don't work. Machines perched on top of buildings, too much turbulence. It's the freestanding, big tower, three blade into the wind machines that are going to make the money, and they make huge amounts of money. And what bothers me about the Cape Wind project is that it's privately owned. We have windmills going in off the south part of Long Island. The people there are every bit as rich, as every bit as finicky. There was opposition, but that project is owned by LIPA, the Long Island Power Authority. For all its problems, it's still public owned. Okay? Now, what's happening in this country to the wind business is very interesting and indicative and may have an impact on nuclear. It's not clear yet, but it could. 50% of the windmills being built and installed in the United States are now being built by General Electric. Now, that can be problematic. That's a discussion. But they really just provide the wind machines. 50% of the projects also are being developed by FPL Energy, which is a subsidiary of Florida Power and Light, which happens to own four nuclear plants and has no wind power whatsoever in Florida. And what they do is that they go in and they pay a royalty to farmers. You know, they come in and say, hi, these old farmers, they say, hi, we want to buy your wind rights. And the guy, sure, you know. And they sell them, and they're worth a fortune. And then they're getting, it's like the old oil wildcatters or whatever, selling mineral rights that the farmers didn't know the true value of. So what we are doing, I'm working with Dan Jewell, the guy in southwestern Minnesota. He figured this out, and basically what we're trying to do is show farmers how to build their own wind farms. And we believe in the long run, this will give, first of all, they'll make 10 to 20 times as much money. The average lease payment that a wind developer pays to a farmer on whose land they build a windmill is $2,000 to $3,000 a year per machine. But if the farmer owns the windmill, he or she can make $20,000 to $30,000 per machine. And more after 10 years when the principal's paid off. So the reality is that what we're trying to do is build a network of farmers who own their own wind farms and give it a community base. The other part of it is that the best utilities that are involved in the wind business now are the municipals, not surprisingly. And those of you who don't think we've had an impact, in 1989, as you'll remember, thanks to NIRS and SEC and Helen and so many other people campaigning, the city of Sacramento, which had a municipal utility, voted to shut the Rancho Seco nuclear plant. First time it happened in history, June of 1989. And guess what happened the day after they voted? It shut. Amazing. No 20 years of court battles, none of this, none of that, because they owned it. Now, Sacramento, as a municipal, has now gone ahead and invested in wind power. They've done solar. They've done conservation. They're doing all the green stuff. If you want to find a poster child for a utility, Sacramento Municipal Utility Company is it, SMUD. Now, the reason we got wind power in northern Ohio is not just because wind power finally became profitable, but because a municipal, thank you, a municipal utility did it. The Bowling Green, the city of Bowling Green, has a municipal utility. Now, would First Energy, dare I say the name, the owner of the Davis-Bessey nuclear plant, chime in and cooperate? Would they buy any power? Hell no. They won't touch it. They've got Davis-Bessey, they've got Perry. They don't want their nuclear investments messed with. So what Bowling Green had to do was pull together its own consumer base from other municipal utilities. And as a result of that, they've been able to sell their power, their cheaper power, to their fellow munis, and they're now going to build two more big windmills. And that's absolutely crucial. If you're interested, really, in pushing this and in pushing wind power in your community, the first step to take is to get a municipal utility in place, because that's where the real market is. So the reality then becomes, if we can own some of this wind power, if farmers can build their own wind farms, which we've shown we can, one of the reasons I have Dan's website up there is Dan and I, he asked me to come with him and write a handbook on how to do that. So all of you who own a couple of sections of land in Kansas, see me afterwards and I can show you exactly how to do it. It is a remarkable, revolutionary process, and it's really happening fast, and it's immensely profitable. So now the upshot is that if we can have a network of people across the United States building and operating and owning their own wind farms, we will be able to get out from under some of this commercial load from these ridiculous nuclear plants, which operate far less efficiently. Now, the reality is that because wind is intermittent, a megawatt of wind power will only generate about 333 usable megawatts the way they scale it. So basically, for capacity, you have to build three times as many much windmill capacity as allegedly you have to build nuclear capacity. But of course, that's on the presumption that the nukes are going to operate 100% of the time, which we know is a total drug fantasy. We have 14 nukes around Chicago. Zion is gone, and another one's gone, so we're down to 11. And at no time that I've ever been here has more than half of them been operating. So that's a myth. But to fill the thumbnail sketch of what the utilities expect, you got to build three times as much new capacity as they have. But even at that, it comes in at $3 million a megawatt. There is nowhere on this planet that you can build a nuclear plant or even start to talk about building a nuclear plant for $3 million a megawatt. It ain't going to happen. So the reality is that nukes are being blown away by wind power. And if ever you're in an argument and they want to tell you that a nuke is cheap, forget it. We have won that battle. It's over. Economically, in strict terms of dollars and cents, in strict terms of profitability, we are in the age of wind power. How big is the industry? In 2001, in Texas alone, and someone unmentionable had just been governor there, they built $900 million worth of windmills, 900 megawatts. The American wind industry and the world wind industry have been growing at a rate of 25 to 30% a year. It is now, by all standards of calculation, a $5 to $10 billion a year industry worldwide, and at the rate of 30% a year, it will double and triple in the next 10 years easily. So many, many, many more megawatt hours of wind capacity are being installed on this planet as we speak, as are new nuclear megawatts. And it will continue that way. The dollar argument is on our side. The free market is on our side. And all we got to do now is stop the governments from sticking in money, and nuclear power is dead, dead, dead.
That was Harvey Wasserman, senior editor of the Free Press, speaking at the Nuclear Power and Children's Health Conference in Chicago, October 16th. His web address is hw.com. From the Trenches is produced by Chicago's Independent Media Center. You can post your own stories, listen to this program again, find links to news and upcoming events in Chicago and around the world through our internet address. The address is www.chicago.indymedia.org. Listen again on the fourth Monday in December for another report from the Trenches.